Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Once again, pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got Senior Voices and WISO's occasional art series, Culture Couch. Several years ago in that series, we featured an organization called We Care Arts. The group provides the opportunity for disabled individuals to create, market, and sell their own works of art. This past week, I stopped by for an update on how the organization is doing and to talk about some fun events they have on the horizon. Up first, last week, a WISO investigation revealed thousands of kindergarten through third grade students are suspended each year. State data shows school officials remove children of color from the classroom much more often than white children. Officials most often cited, quote, disruptive behaviors as the reason for removing children, behaviors such as not following directions or talking out of turn. Some advocates are pushing for teachers to seek alternative approaches to classroom discipline. To learn more about what some of those alternatives might be, we spoke with Scott Irvin. He's a former Ohio public school educator. He's since left the classroom to run a for-profit business designed to teach adults new ways to handle child behavior. Scott, you're well known as the Kid Whisperer. We've had several conversations over the past couple of years about the work you're doing with children. Let's just reiterate for our listeners the work that you're doing now.
So I show adults how to be calm, strict, and loving with kids, whether you are a teacher, a parent, a bus driver, lunch lady, paraprofessional. I show you how to be calm and assertive with kids without having to use any anger, without using threats, without using any warnings. So I allow you to be the most strict, calm, and the most loving adult that you can possibly be.
And you know a lot about this. You're a former teacher and use these principles on your own.
That's right. I have worked as a teacher, principal, discipline specialist, really concentrating on working with kids who could be termed at risk, very high level of poverty in most of the kids. Lots of adverse childhood experiences have been experienced by my students. So I've used these skills and these procedures to elicit the positive behaviors that I need for kids to be successful in my class, and they need to be successful in life.
So how do you bring them into that area of knowledge?
Well, first, they come to me. That's really important. You know, we try to do outreach to parents and to teachers and to principals, but they have to be ready to learn. They have to have sort of gone through the process of grief of not being the parent they want to be or not being the teacher that they want to be because they can't get the positive behaviors from kids that they need to get. But I teach two things, really. The 9 essential skills for the Love and Logic classroom and parenting skills with Love and Logic and calm, assertive procedures for the classroom and for the school. So we have tons and tons of research that shows that building relationships with kids and sharing control with them in a healthy way is a great way for them to be cooperative and happy. But there's really nothing out there that really shows you step by step how to do that. How do you build relationships with kids? How do you share control in a healthy way? Just being nice to kids doesn't work with really difficult kids because really difficult kids are going to push back when you try to build relationships with them because generally really difficult kids often will have low self-esteem and they'll have a lot of trust issues. So when you say, I think you're fantastic, a difficult kid's going to think, I'm not fantastic and what do you want from me? Right? So we show specific ways how to build relationships with kids, how you go out of your way for kids, how you greet every single kid within what we call an ESPN greeting, which is eye contact, smile, physical contact, and name every single kid every single day. So yesterday, for instance, I was in a school in Cincinnati where I was doing an audit of the school, their brand new building. And we were figuring out where teachers and paraprofessionals and principals and lunch ladies and custodians were going to stand so that they could give kids ESPN greetings as they walked in to change their brain chemistry, to keep their arousal level low so that they can learn, so that they're ready to learn, so that they're ready to be happy, so that they're not in fight or flight. Because if a kid just came from an abusive situation at home, we're going to need to change his brain chemistry before he gets into the classroom. And that's part of what we do, making sure kids are ready to learn no matter what just happened at home, making sure kids are ready to learn when they come to school.
And I think you just touched on one of the challenges. You're teaching adults how to interact with these children, but in many cases, it's adults that are creating challenges
for the kids?
I would say almost always it's the adults causing the challenges for the kids. You know, at home, broken people create broken people. And if at home kids are being abused, kids are constantly in fight or flight, they're constantly scared, they're constantly nervous, they don't know where their next meal is coming from, they don't know whether or not they're going to be hit or be abused that night, well, they're not in the right frame of mind. So difficult kids, they have a tremendous need for control, because at home, they're having the control taken away from them in the form of abuse or neglect. And so kids, when they come to school, they're thinking, well, sort of their thought in their mind is like, no offense, teacher, but I need a lot of control. So I'm going to take it from you. I'm going to act out. I'm going to stop you from teaching. I'm going to be as obnoxious as possible. Well, I've got to be able to know how to share the control I don't need anyway, share that control with those kids, because I can either share control on my terms or they're going to take it on theirs. So as soon as a kid, the moment a kid walks in, we're going to start giving them choices about things. And we're going to have those choices planned out in the form of the procedures that we teach. So we're going to have, we're not just going to say, get to work. We're going to say, all right, we're going to start work. Who would like to have silent workshop? Raise of hands. Who would like to have whispering workshop? Show of hands. Who would like to have soft talking workshop? Show of hands. Well, 98% of the time it's going to be soft talking, right? They're going to choose that anyway, but I gave them the choice. So the most difficult kids, all the kids are going to love it, but it's absolutely essential for the most difficult kids. Without that, you're not going to be successful.
You talked about being in a school and deciding where teachers would stand to offer greetings to children as they came in. That's something that I don't think many people are thinking about these days. How does an idea like that come to you, and how does it come to fruition?
So that's a great question. So it comes to me completely out of necessity. I worked at a school where we had a quarter mile long hallway where there were no adults in it during dismissal. And we're dismissing 500 kids down that single hallway. It was chaos. And there's no real judgment there, because administrators and teachers, they're tasked with doing the job of three people. Just the idea, it's hard enough to open up a building, make sure that it has electricity and running water, and that the teachers are all there, and everyone is equipped to do the basic job. So the way that it really happens is, we've got this learning box that we're going to open, and we're going to put kids in it, and then we're going to get them in, then we got to have them learn, and then we got to get them out. Principals and teachers don't have the time to think about and plan out every single detail that is absolutely necessary to have a safe and comfortable school for kids. You know, we talk about bullying. You know, we see videos and movies about bullying. All I can think when I see bullying in schools is, where are the adults? You have a hallway, you have no adults. You've got an 80% generational poverty rate in these schools, and that statistically says that kids have had, very likely most of these kids have between 2 and 7 adverse childhood experiences, which really makes it more difficult for them to learn, more difficult for them to make good choices, and makes it more likely that they're going to cause problems for other kids. You can't leave kids like that alone for long periods of time with each other. There's going to be, most kids are still going to be great, but there's going to be some kids who are going to hurt other kids. So we want to make those, and that's what I was doing yesterday in Cincinnati, going through a school that hasn't even opened yet, and going through and saying, all right, we need a teacher here. We need a teacher here. Today, right before I came, I was figuring out how we're going to do monitoring of bathrooms during the school day in a school of 900 kids. Those things have to be thought of and thought about, or else you're just using prayer as a behavior management strategy. Like, please don't have kids hurt each other while they're alone in the hallway. That just can't happen. And so I have sort of an obsessive personality, which really helps me thinking, how do I make this building as safe as possible? And what are the adults going to be doing? They're not going to be, if they're going around screaming at kids, telling them not to bully each other, it's just going to make things worse. But if we give adults relationship building procedures, preventive procedures, and consequences, both immediate and delayed, we're going to allow them to be incredibly calm and incredibly assertive to get the positive pro-social behaviors that kids need to have, for the adults to have a good day, for kids to have a good day, and for the kids and adults to be able to be in a school where learning and teaching can take place.
So I love it when people I'm speaking with answer the next question before I get a chance to ask it, which was your teaching experience. The last time we talked was in one of the largest primary schools in the state, and you had a lot of kids, a lot of teachers in those rooms and hallways. What was within you during that time where you had time to think about things like this and how adults interact with children and where they might stand to make education a better experience for them? You touched on your obsessive personality. Can you just elaborate on that and how far back that goes to the beginning of your education experience?
Yeah, it really did go to the first day as a teacher. I taught and was a principal in Dayton for a decade, and I was in Fairborn for 6 years after that. And from the beginning, I had 2 years without these skills and without these procedures. I hadn't learned the skills. I hadn't created the procedures yet. And I had 2 years of screaming and yelling at kids. And the only thing I had going for me, besides just an attitude of I have to figure out how to do this, is I thought this is not acceptable. This is the only thing I've ever wanted to do, which is work with at-risk kids. And I can't do it. I can't even come close to doing it. Why is that? And I was always asking that. Every day I would say, why is this? Why can I not figure this out? And I would ask people, this isn't the way any of us wanted to teach. And there was a lot of excuses, understandable excuses, excuses about the kids' poverty level, excuses about home life, excuses about a lack of funding. All of those things are, there's certainly truth in everything, in all of those things. But that's not good enough for me, because this is what I want to do with my life. And so I, from the beginning, was obsessed with figuring it out. So after I read a book called Teaching with Love and Logic by Jim Fay and David Funk, I started to use these skills, and then I started to create my own procedures for implementing the why of what I learned while I was supposedly learning how to be a teacher, become a teacher, which is, why are these kids like this? Well, they need a lot more control than other kids. Kids need a lot of control. You need to build relationships with kids. I was told this by college professors. Well, that's useless by itself. In fact, it's worse than useless for me, because I was told why these kids were so vulnerable, why these kids were acting out. That doesn't help me. I need to know how to be calm and assertive with these kids. And that really, I learned about love and logic. That was the only thing that ever worked. But then we also need these procedures for systematically giving away control in a healthy way and building relationships with kids. And that's why I'm so excited about our conference that we're doing. And I teach these things all across the country. But we're actually doing a conference over the course of 3 days in Yellow Springs, Ohio, where we're actually teaching how to, in the first 3 weeks of your school year, whether you're teaching kindergarten through 12th grade, how to give away control in a healthy way and build relationships with kids. You can actually, in 3 days, you can come away with 3 weeks worth of lesson plans that will put in place procedures for building relationships and sharing control. And then after those 3 weeks, the kids will run the classroom, because that's part of the control that we give away. In my classroom, using these procedures, there was very little to rebel against. Now, I'm the most strict teacher I've ever seen. I travel across the country coaching teachers, and I'm the most strict teacher I've ever seen. I'm also the most calm. And so I was able to just give away so much control that there was nothing to rebel against. I had these really difficult kids who would want to have the control of running the classroom, coming up with a prompt for when it was time to clean up breakfast, when it was time to get ready for lunch, when it was time to switch classes. So those type of control sharing things, that's what we're teaching. We're teaching those things explicitly and systematically so that we're giving kids the control that they need, so they don't try to take control on their terms. We're giving it away on our terms.
Let's give folks the information they need for the conference, who's invited, who should take part in it, and where can they get more information.
So it's Calm Assertive Academy. It will be in beautiful Yellow Springs, Ohio, which is one of my favorite towns in the United States, by the way. And it's going to be at the Mills Park Hotel, and it's July 23rd, 24th, and 25th. This is for teachers. I have another conference that's for teachers and parents, but this is for teachers, kindergarten through 12 teachers. And they can register at irvineducationalconsulting.com. irvineducationalconsulting.com, and you can just click on conferences, and you'll see there's Calm Assertive Academy, and that's what we're talking about, but there's also Kid Whisperer University, which is August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and those are love and logic skills, neutralizing arguing, delaying consequences. Yeah, we're really excited about both conferences. And we sold out Kid Whisperer University last year. This is the first year we're going to be offering Calm Assertive and Kid Whisperer. And we're selling really well. So there's going to be a lot of people, but we're keeping the numbers low, especially for Calm Assertive, because really it's going to be really interactive, where I actually am going to, for the last day, sort of treat the adults as children and run the classroom like I would run my own classroom, with using the relationship building procedures and control sharing procedures as well.
Scott, I think what you're doing is very important. Before we go, just talk a little bit about why you think what you're doing today is so important.
It's everything. There's nothing in the world more important than human beings using positive pro-social behaviors. Nothing. Nothing will work. No society will work if people are using negative antisocial behaviors. No society will work when people are trained to use negative behaviors that cause problems for people. We can't have employment, we can't have a civil society, we can't have a safe society without people using positive pro-social behaviors. That's what civilized society is. And we're really moving away from that right now. The discourse in our country is, nobody ever asks, does this cause a problem? Am I causing a problem for another person? Am I making the world better instead of worse right now? Right now, we're systematically training children who are going to become adults, if they live that long, to use negative behaviors to get what they want. What these procedures and these skills do is they give kids two choices and two choices only, all the time. You can either be cooperative and use positive pro-social behaviors, or you can suffer consequences, delivered with empathy, but you will suffer consequences for not using positive pro-social behaviors. So we're training kids to be happy, healthy people that make the world better instead of worse.
Scott Irvin, thanks for your time.
You are welcome. Thank you.
I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. This summer, WYSO's Culture Couch series is taking us backstage to meet some of the local makers of stagecraft. Debbie Henderson's love of costume design began in the eighth grade and has followed her throughout her life. She's worked for 32 years at Wittenberg University as costume shop manager and designer for theater productions, but one type of clothing in particular has become Debbie's passion: men's hats. She's written books and is known nationally for her collection. Debbie showed Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus around her workspace at her home in Yellow Springs.
Debbie Henderson's workspace is a shrine to men's headwear. Hats of every conceivable style and color are hung on coat racks and stacked half a dozen high on tables. They're even tucked away on bookshelves. Colorful vintage hat boxes are displayed on high shelves that run the length of the room.
Boy, look at these Disney hats with these Courier and Ives pictures on them. And here's a Western hat box, thoroughbred hats with these engraving of these gorgeous wild horses.
Debbie's love of men's hats began when she started work on her PhD at the Union Institute nearly 20 years ago. As a costume designer, she knew that clothing would play a part in her research, but she wasn't sure what her focus would be. And then,
I was watching Sherlock Holmes on TV, and I realized that Watson had on a brown derby, not black, and I went, oh, that's different. All of a sudden, it just hit me, men's hats. I didn't know anything about them, really.
And neither did most people, Debbie says, as there wasn't much information out there about men's hats. An unfortunate historical oversight that she intended to rectify.
What I did is I stumbled into a black hole. When I put my committee together, one woman said, well, why don't you do women's hats? It's just everybody does women's hats. There are hundreds of books out there on women's hats. There are now some books on men's hats. I did four books and ended up kind of the world's expert on men's hats.
Debbie's dissertation research took her all over the world. She visited dozens of museums and historical societies. She went to Italy and Canada and Prague, and even interviewed Clint Eastwood's costume designer. But she says she was surprised, even in the museums she visited, about the general lack of love for men's hats.
One of the first museums I went to, the curator, when he was getting the men's hats out, said, oh, gee, if I could throw these away, I would. they just don't care.
People who know Debbie often donate hats to her collection, something that also happened during this interview.
So my husband sent me with a hat.
I never said no to a hat.
Ever.
This is, it's in a Knox hat box of New York City, perfectly new, never been worn, Saban Brothers menswear, Wilmington, Ohio, size 7. It's gray, it's fur felt, kind of a cross between a Homburg, which is a little more formal hat, and a fedora, but it could be anywhere from the 60s on. And this is cool. It's got a little red feather in the hat band, which gives it a little more sporty look.
Debbie's on-the-spot hat identification is the kind of thing she has to do as part of her theater work. Any play that takes place before 1960, she says, means the men on stage have to wear hats. And finding the right hat is paramount.
A cabaret opened a month after spring break, the Sally Bowles love interest. Now, he was supposed to be in brown tones. He was traveling on a train in the play. He would have never shown up on a train without a hat. I didn't have a good brown fedora, and I want a really good hat. So we go to antique malls everywhere we are, and there was a gorgeous 1930s brown fedora that fit him perfectly.
While the kinds of hats she studied are either props or historical fancies these days, Debbie says it's important to remember that men's hats were once a part of everyday life.
If you look at pictures of miners or people in any occupation, they had a hat on that indicated their class, what they did. People wore their hats, then they passed them on to relatives, and they wore them. So unless they were saved, like your father-in-law's hat that was never worn and it was in a closet, they wore them out.
And though the era of daily formal hat wearing is mostly past, Debbie says she thinks more men should consider adding them back into their wardrobes.
It gives you a real sense of style. You can crease it and bend it to your own personality. I just think they give you a very individual look. I think it makes you stand out. You know, I just want to stand out. I guess theater people are like that.
For WYSO's Culture Couch, I'm Lauren Schaus.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. And while we're on the subject, this past week I paid a visit to an organization we introduced you to some time ago. I wanted to get an update on how the group is doing and to talk about some fun events they have coming up. We Care Arts and Catering gives individuals with disabilities the opportunity to create, market, and sell their own works of art. For the update, first I spoke with Executive Director Darlene Langhout, and then Development Director Christine Korba will tell us about some events coming up that you might not want to miss.
I believe in the healing of art and the ability of being able to let yourself go and let the anxiety and things associated with a lot of what our clients bring here, letting that go through art and being able to express yourself and work through some of those things. I had experience with We Care Arts through a grief program. My husband passed away in 2013, and my daughter and I were able to work through that program. It was a 10-week program, and have some therapeutic art in order to put us in a better place. And so, having experienced it, I truly believe the ability for it to work for all individuals, not just our primary client base, but we step outside of that pretty frequently.
Reiterate for us the mission of We Care Arts here in Kettering.
Sure. We like to say changing disabilities into possibilities. We cater to people with developmental disabilities, physical handicaps, and mental health challenges. And we bring them here and we teach them art. We market and sell their completed artworks and we pay them a commission. So wrapped into that, we build confidence, we build focus, we teach responsibilities through all of that programming. And in the end, a lot of our clientele that we help could be on SSI or low income, fixed incomes, and a lot of them rely on that commission that they make off of their artwork. But tied into selling a piece of art, I don't know if you've ever created art, but to think of what you made, someone is buying it or even seeking it out, it builds your confidence to a new level.
And how many artists do you work with?
Last year, annually, we were just under 1,600. So it's a pretty big number. Just in our cancer units alone, we work with about 450 a year. So, and that's families, cancer patients, and doctors and nurses. We have a varying client base, as you can probably hear in what I'm saying. We work in 11 different high schools in the area. We have 42 off-site locations. So we are bigger than people know, and we do the work that it's real magic around the table is how I like to describe it with my staff. I say this is where the magic happens, and this is what people don't get to see. So we need to make sure we tell them outside of our building where we are and what we're doing.
And beyond the 11 schools, you're also working with healthcare groups?
Absolutely. We work with Kettering Medical Center and Premier Health. We also partner with the Epilepsy Foundation here in Dayton. We have a class with them. We have a class at Rosewood. It's called Autism for Buddies, where we help preschool-age children with autism. And that's in addition to various school systems, particularly Dayton Public. We go to Stivers and also Belmont, where we serve their disabled, developmentally disabled students. Centerville High School and Kettering Fairmont actually come here on site, which is another layer to that program because they're children who are not typical high school age. So they've aged out of high school, but they're mentally still in high school. So they're in a different program within the high schools, and they get on a bus and they come here. So that adventure in itself is teaching them life skills. They have to get on the bus. They have to make sure that they're paying attention and they're on time. And then when they get here, they start their own project. You know, they get their journal. There's a process to it that helps them learn life skills.
I think the numbers of artists that you're working with is staggering. I certainly didn't realize that. How fast is your organization growing, and will you be able to serve many more clients?
This year, we're anticipating doubling the on-site program here. So by the end of 2018, that would mean roughly 500 here on site, which would probably bring us for the year of 2018, I would say probably around 2,500 people served. So roughly 20% annually is what I anticipate our growth being overall.
And Christina, you have some very important events coming up that we'd like to highlight. Let's talk about some of them.
Yeah, we have some really fun stuff coming up. The first thing that's coming up is on August 4th. We have a 5K and also a festival going on in the same day. It's going to be a very full day of fun, and we're all going to be exhausted, but it'll be a good time. The 5K starts at 8 o'clock. It'll be at 8 o'clock in the morning. It'll be at Indian Riffle Park. And what's really special about this 5K is that every finisher receives a medal that was handcrafted by our clients. And they are all one of a kind. They're not the kind of cookie cutter medals that you typically get when you go to most 5Ks. And it's fun. It's fully accessible. And if folks are interested in signing up for that 5K, they can go to 5kwecarearts.itsyourrace.com and sign up. And if you want a t-shirt, you have to sign up by July 24th. So time's a wasting. So make sure that you get online and sign up. And then later on that afternoon, we have a festival, Arts and Drafts. By the way, if you sign up for the 5K, you get into the festival for free. It's a fun event. And we have got live music, bands including Man Ray, the Boxcar Suite, the New Old Fashioned, Mavis Pearly, and our friend Chris Ryder just passing through will be playing all day long. We'll have food trucks, Toxic Brew is going to be there, pouring beer. And what makes this event really unique is that we have on-site tattooing. So we have got about 16 tattoo artists coming from across the country, as well as local tattoo artists who are going to be tattooing for a cause. And so at least 50% of the cost of your tattoo that day will go toward We Care Arts. And a lot of the tattoo artists are donating 100% of the cost of the tattoo. And this year's theme is superheroes. What's exciting, we just found out that we have got autographed posters from Jason Momoa and Josh Brolin, and those are going to be available as well for people to take a look at and possibly bid on or raffle off. So it's going to be a fun evening.
Just the logistics of what you're describing to me sounds very challenging.
This is the fifth year we've done it, and quite honestly, by 11 o'clock on Saturday night, I will be in a corner just rocking and humming to myself.
So, yeah, it's going to be an exhausting day. But it's really fun. And I think one of the things that is unique about this event is that a lot of times people put, you know, bands and tattooing. They think it's going to be something that's not family friendly. Yet it is. We have all kinds of people that bring their kids to this event. We have a kids zone where we're going to have carnival games. And we've got somebody who's coming in and drawing pictures of your kids as superheroes. And it is. It's fun for the whole family.
Great. And time and location again on this event?
It's going to be on August 4th. The 5K is in the morning. It starts at 8 a.m. And then Arts and Drafts is between 2 p.m. and 10 p.m. And it is at We Care Arts, 3035 Wilmington Pike in our back lot. And you can go to wecarearts.eventbrite.com for more information.
And what's your attendance been in past years?
We've been getting about 1,500 people that come throughout the day. So it is a lot of folks that now I'm of a certain demographic. And when I tell people that we're doing this event, they look at me and go, oh, really? But what's really cool about this is that I have so many of my friends that come to this event and they're like, wow, this isn't what I expected it was going to be. So, you know, anybody from little kids all the way up to older adults, you're going to find something fun to do that day.
You also have an event in September, I believe, at the Dublin Pub.
Yes, on September 27th will be the Dublin Pub. We've got Doolahan playing, and we've got Irish dancers coming as well. And it's just a fun evening, just after work kind of a thing, where you can come, have a snack, enjoy a beverage, and listen to some great Irish music. And it's called Irish at Heart, and more information about that will be available soon.
Do you have a silent auction early in the year that you're also planning?
Yes. Every spring we have our annual spring auction. It's a pretty big event, and that'll be in March. We also have an evening at the races, which takes place in May. And then, of course, the Arts and Drafts and the 5K in the summertime. And we're hoping that we keep the Irish at Heart going, because that's proven to be quite popular. And then in October, we have a style show that features wearable art that was created by our artists here at We Care Arts. And if you want more information about any of the events that we're promoting at We Care Arts that help our client base, you can follow us on Facebook. Just look for We Care Arts and we'll pop up right there. We're on Instagram and also on Snapchat. And you can also take a really good look at what our artists are making. They feel so proud of everything that they do, and they feel really good about it when people take a look at what they're doing too. So please follow us on Facebook.
You've got a number of successful events. You're expanding here in your art space. So clearly the community is responding to your funding needs.
We are very blessed at We Care Arts. We do have a lot of people that love us, but now we're growing and we would love to bring in more friends to We Care Arts. It's one of those things that once you walk into this building, once you see a piece of the art that our clients have created and how proud they feel about themselves, you fall in love with it. And that's exactly why I'm here at We Care Arts. I came in as a donor back in the day. And as soon as I walked into this building, I fell in love with it. I knew that I needed to be of service to this organization. And I feel really blessed to be able to work for them and to be able to bring new people in who want to support what we do.
Well, great. I hope more community members hear about your mission and respond to the needs of this organization. You're doing great, great work. Christina and Darlene, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was great to meet you.
Thank you for having us today. We appreciate the opportunity.
We Care Arts Executive Director Darlene Langhout and Development Director Christine Korba. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. This past week on Senior Voices, John Johnson remembers a rich period in Dayton music history and working in concert promotion back in the 1960s and 70s. One venue he worked at was the Palace Theater, which stood across North Main Street from the Victory Theater. John shared his story with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Liz Anderson.
Well, I love music, so I got a chance to play instrumental music. I had a great couple of teachers. One of the music teacher that taught instrumental music, his name was Gilbert Unger. And he allowed me and convinced my mom that it was all right that I changed instruments every year. So I started out playing one instrument, and before you knew it, by the time grade school was over, I had played trombone, saxophone, violin, drums, piano, and I just kept going on from there. I played organ in church growing up, and that's what my attachment to music really was, is in playing gospel music. But of course, as I became a teenager, I kind of fell in love with Grand Funk Railroad, and that started me out into listening to rock and roll. Right now, I do play guitar still in a local band called Sonic Mojo, but I've had plenty of opportunities to play music professionally. I got to play with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas and Lou Christie, and even did a couple of shows with Chubby Checker. In October of 74, I started working for the Victory Theater. So I went to school at Sinclair and worked at the theater at the same time. And I stayed at the theater till about 1976. I got a chance to start from the bottom and work my way up to even being house manager before I left. And that's when I got into doing promotions with different shows and that kind of thing. And I got a chance to, you know, work for Belkin Enterprises and Ross Todd and Jam Productions. Those were the production companies that brought all the shows to the area here, Hair Arena, Palace Theater. That's what I really remember about that era the most, of being involved with putting concerts on in Dayton and getting a chance to get my friends in or sneak them in, you know, to the Palace. And we got to see some great acts there, like Kiss when they were first starting out, Mark Bolan, and let's see, Robert Palmer with Vinegar Joe. Robert Palmer was in that band when they came. Joe Walsh with Barnstorm, and Bachman Turner Overdrive when they first came out. You know, we got a chance to do all those shows and see them first at the Palace, and have them here in Dayton maybe in the spring, and then by late summer they were coming back playing Hair Arena, filling up the place, you know, that kind of thing. I'm probably one of the few people that still had the ability at the time to go through the underground underneath Main Street from the Victoria Opera House to the Palace. See, a lot of people don't know that in the heyday, when those were the old school, you know, working theaters, that the stagehands sometimes worked both houses, and they accessed them through a passageway that actually went under Main Street from one house to the other. And I used to get to walk around down through there before they filled all that in. And then they tore down the Palace and broke my heart. But we managed to save the Victory. That was part of a campaign I worked on. I'm glad they saved it. It's a beautiful house.
That was John Johnson speaking with Liz Anderson as part of the Senior Voices Project. It was the end of an era when the Palace was demolished in 1975. This interview was edited by Community Voices podcaster Patty Garrett. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.